So thank you for inviting me, and I'm excited to do this for the first time. And I have to warn you that as a law professor, I usually don't lecture. I don't know if any of you have seen all the movies about law professors, The Paper Chase, etc., but you know, law professors only ask questions. They never give answers, and they never lecture. They just make all the students work. So I'm going to see whether we can do a little of that today. We'll see. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But at least the start way, which is that I am going to ask you to try to intuit what the answer might be to a question that we're struggling with today. And then we'll go and we'll look at the sources and see what the sources have to say. So what is the question? Well, we know that we're living in a time of war, and certainly so in the state of Israel. And one of the questions, the main question I want to address is this, which is, how do we know what to do? I don't mean militarily or strategically, but I mean what resources from our life do we look at when we try to think about how to conduct a war? We certainly think in the modern world today that we should be looking at international law. These standards bind us. But is that what we should be looking at, or should we be looking at the halakha? We should be looking at our mesorah, our tradition. And how do we do that if the reality is that our mesorah had very little occasion to engage with laws of war, because for the most part, Jews were living in conditions in which they had no army, and they were not engaging in wars. So what do we do? So if people understood this question, and if you didn't, I'll ask it again. But if you understood this question, I just want you to throw out any ideas you have about where do you go to get some enlightenment? So experience, right? So that would say that basically war is a political thing. It has nothing to do with law. It has nothing to do with ethics. It's an activity that people engage in with experience. And it's outside ideas of law and ideas of ethics. Is that right? It's a response based on experience. Okay, so that's one answer. Okay, let me hear some more. Say that again. Right, so the Rambam has an extensive section on laws of kings, and in his section on laws of kings, he deals with what wars are permitted and what wars are not permitted. Right, okay. So in a sense, what your answer is, well, we'll look at our Jewish sources, right? We'll look at the codes, right? And we'll see what the codes have to say. Right, that will tell us. Right, so one idea is the codes. Okay, the codes are, the Rambam, it's not extensive, let's put it that way, right? Right? It's looking to the past and the future. So it's not in the form of, let's say, a large body of responsa literature that gives you, right, some sort of real guidance on a practical level or on a level of, what do I do now? Right? Okay, but that's another response. Well, you know what? Let me put it this way. You know, when people are trained to fight, whether we're talking about armies in the United States or armies in Israel, they're, part of experience is education. They're educated. And they are taught, these are the rules of war, right? And this is how you should react in certain situations, right? Not just practically, but also in terms of ethically or morally. That's part of the training of being in a military organization. And codes are formulated based on that. Right? And international agreements are formulated based on that. Right? International agreements about how to conduct war. So what can we then learn from? Just to think about the background or do everything based on just kind of instinct in the field? What do you think? Okay, we're going to accept as a given that you are right, that the situation is complicated, right? And there's no question that what I'm not going to do is address how we should fight wars, because I have no idea, right? That is, I'm as clueless as all the rest of us about how we're going to really accomplish our goals. I'd like to deal with a question that actually has a lot to do with Jewish identity and what we think our religious life should look like today. And that's a question that's using war as an example, a very dramatic example, but it's not meant to address how are we going to fight in a practical level. It's asking us instead to think, when we think about where we're going to build a code of war or a code of ethics for conducting war, as all nations do, where should we as Jews look? That's what it's asking. So I'm going to repeat that, right? When the United States sits down to develop, right, international agreements that it signs off on, or when it sits down to develop its own military code of war or military code of ethics, right, it looks to a tradition. Most of the tradition that it looks to actually is the Catholic tradition, because that's where they've developed a lot of notions about what is a just war and what is an unjust war and what is a just way to fight a war and what is an unjust practice. When the state of Israel and its citizens think about how they should behave in situations of war, and not just extreme war, but also responses to terrorism, reprisals, etc., how should we, as religious Jews, think about that question? What sources and resources should we look at? And one answer that you gave me already is, we should just look at practical life and practical experience and nothing else. And that's a possible answer, right? That is a possible answer, which says, okay, war is not a legal category. It's not something addressed by the halakha. It's not addressed by law. It's not an ethical subject. All we need to do is think about what makes sense in the moment, and that is it. And therefore, if we were to draft a code, and of course the IDF has a code of war, right, and it has a code of ethics, right, called purity of arms, right, it would really say, just think about what you did in the field last time that worked. And that's the end of it. That would be the end of the code. So that's one possible response. It's a logical response, but it's not the only response. So someone else, right, inciting Maimonides, inciting the Rambam, right, and the Laws of Kings and Hilchot Melachim says, well, maybe if we're going to draft what to do, we as Jews with a sense of Jewish religious identity ought to be thinking about what our Jewish tradition tells us. Maybe that's relevant. So why might it be relevant?
Enemy does not have any hope for advancing or anything else.
Right. Okay, so let me extract something that you're saying there. That's very interesting. No, I think what you're saying is that basically in a situation in which you're not fighting with another, with an enemy who is bound by the same laws as you are, right, that then can't be bound, right, in some way. You have to descend to whatever the level is. You have nothing else, right? That's what you're saying, right? Because basically the only way to have an ethic is if everybody agreed. And if there wasn't complete agreement, then it would be suicidal to have to be bound by, right, notions that... Right. Let me make it clear. I know this is kind of a subtle thing that I'm saying. I am not giving advice on how to fight a war, and I'm not talking politics, and I'm not going to talk politics. What I'm trying for us to get to is a place where we can begin to grapple with halachic sources that are asking this question, this very question. They are rabbis and halachic sources who are asking, where do we look? What are we bound by? And that's a very interesting question that contemporary rabbis in Israel are deeply engaged in, and also the public. So I'm trying for us to just warm ourselves up so that we can get to this question of where are we supposed to look? Because of course, right, a rabbi will say, if the halakha speaks to this, then I have to hear it. I have to listen. I have to pay attention. So the question is, does the halakha speak to it? And how? And in what way? Yep. So you think that if we look at the sources, what we will see is a license to do anything. Right. So, but now you're looking at the sources, right? So then you have to be open to all the sources. We have to look at the sources. That's an answer, right? So you're in agreement. Now you may be quoting different sources, but you're looking at the sources and saying, I need to look at the Masoret, at the Jewish tradition, and sort of see what to do, right? But I need to look at the sources. Now, if you're looking at the sources, you have to do it seriously. So you have to look at all the sources. Your sources, right? All the sources. Okay, a few more answers, and then we'll go. Okay, so you're saying if we look at the sources, we see that war is an accepted category of conduct, right? All of the avot fought wars, people fought wars. We can, right? We can extrapolate that from that, in a sense, going back to your first comment, right? That war is a matter of that's just normal in human life, sadly, and we all fight wars and we learn from our experience in some fashion. Okay, so I'm going to hear. Right, from just one person I haven't heard from yet, and then I'm going to attempt to sort of give some overview. Yep. So at least we have some sources that seem to address this. So you're in it, right? So you two are in agreement, right? Okay, so let me then try to put out five different models that have actually appeared in the last 50 years since the rise of since the establishment of the State of Israel. Five views that are views that we find within the rabbinic community. And then let's explore them and let's explore them through the sources a little. So one view, right, which is a view, is not one that any of you mentioned. And that view is that actually It's true that in the Tanakh, it's true that in the Bible, our ancestors all fought wars. But once we get to Chazal, once we get to the rabbis did not fight wars. They fought wars of Torah. And they viewed all forms of bloodshed to be extremely against the ethos of the Torah. And so one view is the fact that the halacha hasn't dealt with war since basically the Tanakh is because it thinks war is forbidden. That's one view. That is one view. We have to take account of it. We don't have to agree with it necessarily. It may not be where we stand as a community, but that is one logical view. And let's look, for example, at Divrei HaYamim, just to get a little sense of the ethos that informs this view. So that's in your sources on page 3. And if you look at your sources in Divrei HaYamim on page 3, right, it says, this is David instructing his son Shlomo, and David says, Vayomer David l'Shlomo b'no, Ani haya im levavi livnot beit bayit l'shem Hashem Elokai. Vayehi alai dvar Hashem lemor. Dam lavov shafachti u'milchamot gedolot asita lo tivne bayit l'shmi. Ki damim rabin shafach arza l'panai. Right? David is told, David says, I want to build a temple. Right? And God says to David, not you. You don't get to build the temple. And you don't get to build the temple because you spilled blood by fighting many wars. You have blood on your hands. Your son, right, who will not fight wars, he will build the temple. So we have a lot of sources of different kinds. And if we draw on the sources within Chazal, in particular with an emphasis on Chazal, right, we will find that it's a coherent position to take. It's a coherent position, but it's only one. So one position is that, in fact, war is a bad thing that Jews should have very little to do with. Right? That's one position as a halachic response, as a halachic response. Now, we as a community may not agree with that, but as intellectual, learned people, we have to understand where it comes from, right? Where that view comes from. So a second view, right, is that, well, this is just an area of life that has nothing to do with halakha, right? The view that some of you expressed. It's just an area that's outside of halakha. But that's a challenge to it, right? It's just politics, that's all. It's the realm of politics. It's not governed by law at all, including Jewish law, including halakha. But that's an area that's interesting because it's almost a radical thing to say that there are areas of life that the halakha doesn't speak to, that are it's indifferent to, that it's irrelevant. And war is such a big, serious thing that it's quite a statement to say that here's an area where our halakhic tradition just doesn't care and doesn't speak to and is indifferent entirely. So from now on, I'm going to speak and I'll take questions later just so that we can, because we have only half an hour left. So the third idea, and the third idea is that yes, it is an area of law, and it has to be governed by laws, international law, agreements, nations should be coming together and setting standards, and it's extremely important to obey those standards. But what we need to do is understand that war is a universal experience. It's an area of life that is not uniquely Jewish. It's an area of life that we share with others. And if that's the case, maybe then Jews are obligated to law, but not to Jewish law. That is, it's an area that is covered by the very familiar principle that many of you, I'm sure, have heard, Dina de Malchut Adina. Now, what does that principle mean, Dina de Malchut Adina? The law of the land is the law, right? We have dispensations, we have a principle that says you live in the United States, you obey the laws of the state, right? Because that is the halachic instruction. The halachic instruction is that you must obey the laws of the state that you live in. But this is not about a state, right? This is different, right? Conducting war, which states are we going to look at? Well, in a very, very novel responsum, Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli, who was a religious Zionist rabbi, responding to an incident I will tell you about in a moment, writes that we actually can think of Dina de Malchut Adina as applying to not just individuals and not just to an individual's life inside a state, but it applies to the family of nations. It applies to nations within the family of nations. That is, that there is a world community, not just states. And he writes this at the very, very interesting opinion, because he writes it at the right at the beginning of the takeoff in thinking about international law, before it was as developed as it is today. And he says, that's right. Under the principle of Dina de Malchut Adina, what Jews are bound by is international law. And if the halacha would have a more stringent standard of behavior, then Jews are exempt from that halacha under Dina de Malchut Adina. Because all they are required to do is to obey the law of the world order. That's it. Nothing else. And that ties back to what you said, which is that we can't take upon ourselves in conducting war standards of conduct that are so much higher than the rest of the world. We have to be in sync with the rest of the world. Now, he asks a question, an interesting question, and we'll look at it in the sources later. He says, how can this be that the principle of Dina de Malchut Adina is a license to kill in a situation of war? How can it be a license to kill? I thought it was mostly for money matters or fiscal matters, for civil laws, right? And he says, but it is, because war, we have to understand, is still the accepted way that the world community undertakes to have political order, to solve conflicts. And solving conflicts, even through war, is a way of having order in the world. And if it's to have order in the world, then that's a principle that we have to assimilate and the halacha has to deal with. So the third thing is that through the principle of Dina de Malchut Adina, in a very novel and very interesting interpretation, Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli essentially says that Jews are bound by the standards of international law, no more, no less. Now, when he published this opinion, and I was, maybe historically it helps to sort of situate it. When he published this opinion in 1955, some things never changed. The situation in 1955 was not that different from the situation today. In 1955, there was a massacre of the Jewish community by terrorists. And in response, the Jewish community engaged in a reprisal, right? The army engaged in a reprisal. And it committed a reprisal in the village of Kibia. And in that response, a lot of innocent civilians died. Now, we could have questions about how innocent they are because they're harboring terrorists. And that was a question that Rabbi Yisraeli dealt with. But when it came to children, he said, you know, I can't at this point say that they are harboring terrorists. They're children. They don't have an intent to harm yet. It's not possible to view them in the category of people who are complicit. And the Kibia event created, just as today with Gaza, it created an enormous stir in international circles, and it also launched a very serious conversation in Israeli Jewish circles about what contribution do Jews make to this discussion? Do we just say, well, we acted just like the United States did when it dropped a nuclear bomb, right? It ended a war, it resolved the conflict, it killed a lot of innocent people, right? That's our standard. The standard is what the family of nations does, like the United States' response, right, to end World War II, right? Or do we have to, right, confront something more than that? Do we have to actually think that as Jews, we have something to contribute to the discussion of how one should engage in war? And as Jews, we should be reflecting and sensitizing ourselves in some way, right? How do we deal with that? So Rabbi Yisraeli's answer was, no, we have nothing to say as Jews. It's Dina de Malchut Adina. So long as the response to in the Kabiya situation did not violate international law standards, it was absolutely acceptable and justified under halacha. And that provoked a very large outcry. And the gist of that outcry is the title of my talk, which is Identity and Ethics. When you think about following international rules of war, you are also still saying that our tradition doesn't necessarily have something to say about this, or to contribute to this, or to think about, or ways to think about the ethics of war. And that's a very difficult position to take. So let's look at some of the responses, including rabbinic responses, like that of Rabbi Gorin. And in order to get to the response of Rabbi Gorin, which is our final view of Rabbi Gorin is, Yes, I was going to skip over the fourth, but I will, okay, let's, the final view can be divided into two. And the final view is, we Jews are under a duty to develop Jewish laws of war, to pick up the conversation where it left off, and to contribute to civilization by looking at our own sources, ethical sensibilities, etc., that were honed by our sources, and contribute to the discussion. And there are two ways to do it. One way, which is generally exemplified in Haredi circles, actually, is, this is the one I was going to repeat, but I will, is to say, well, we don't have developed laws of war, but we have analogies, and we can make analogies from the case of criminal law. So when you murder somebody, but it's in self-defense, right, you're excused, right? If it's a situation of a rode, for example, somebody is coming towards you as an aggressor, right, and you respond. So in this way, you don't actually develop laws of war. You just, by analogy, continue a halachic tradition. And there's something good about it, which is you've got developed responsa. You have a whole tradition of conversation. So in that way, it's good. But in another way, it's very unrealistic. And it's unrealistic because if today we sat down and said we're going to think about all acts of war on the model of individual crimes, we wouldn't be able to make sense of the world. War is a collective activity in which a lot of innocents get swept up. And if we think about it through the paradigm of only crime, of one person against another, we would have a lot of difficulty constructing something coherent. And so the fifth view is, we must construct from our sources laws of war, but we have to do them as laws of war, And we have to fill what might have been a very, very long, long gap in our history. And so, right, so we'll have to think in unusual ways. Maybe we won't be able to go back to a chain of halachic responsa on Rodev. Maybe we will have to go back to the Tanakh and commentaries on the Tanakh and Parshanut. But maybe that will, through that, we will build something, right, that will answer the question of today and will create a situation in which our lives as religious Jews are not entirely divorced from the world of state affairs and the world of having sovereignty in the world today. So let's look, remaining time, at what Rabbi Gurin does and the way he does it. And he actually starts, without going straight to him, we will start, he gives a very novel interpretation of commentaries on the story of Dina and Shechem. So on page one, you have the story of Dina and Shechem, which is drawn from, right, Breishit. And you all remember the story of Dina and Shechem? Shechem desires Dina, and he captures her, right? And, right, and then through his father, he says, okay, I want to marry her, and let's have a treaty in which we will all, right, we will marry your daughters, and you will marry our daughters, and we will all live in peace and harmony together. And Yaakov and his children respond, right, his children respond in Yaakov's presence and say, well, that's okay, but of course we cannot possibly marry among you unless you first are circumcised, right? That's the condition. And they agreed, and they went and they circumcised themselves. And then, right, Breishit tells us that the children of Yaakov on third day, when they were in lots of pain, destroyed the entire city of Shechem, right? And leveled it, including all of its people, right? All the men were killed. So it's a harsh story, and it's a question, and it raises a question. And that question is made even more difficult by the story of in Breishit, which is a source that you have just down further in the page, in which Yaakov gives blessings, right, to his children upon his deathbed. And what does he say, right, to Shimon and Levi, who were in the forefront of avenging, right, of avenging Dina? And he says to them, you're cursed for this violent act. You brought dishonor on me. So how do we put this together? Now, the Rambam and the Ramban had a very large debate about this. The Ramban addresses this question, and he's asking, were they justified or not, Shimon and Levi? Right? Were they justified in doing this act? And he concludes by saying, yes, they were legally justified under the halacha. Why? Because the people of Shechem had all participated in violating the Shiva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. They all participated in the snatching of Dina, and not a single one of them said, don't do this. Don't do this terrible thing. And therefore, they were complicit. And since, right, and instead, what they were supposed to do, according to the Shivat Mitzvot V'nei Noach, according to the seven laws of Noah, they were under a duty to punish people who violate basic norms of civilized behavior. That's the duty that everyone has, not just Jews, right? Everyone has to not steal, not kill, right? Everyone. And if they and they're also instructed, Maimonides says, to establish courts to punish people who violate. That's a civilized society. Those that don't are an uncivilized society. And so Maimonides concludes that since they didn't punish, the people of Shechem did not, right, protest or punish this, these bad acts, that Shimon and Levi were justified in doing it themselves. And the Ramban disagrees with him completely. He says, I can't see this. First of all, I disagree that this is the sole interpretation of what the seven laws of Noah are. But then he says, but look at the way in which Yaakov cursed them and said this was wrong. There's something here that indicates that there was some form of chilul Hashem, that there was some way in which their avenging was not right. And he identifies it. And he says, because there really were innocents among Shechem, the city of Shechem, people who didn't participate in this wrong. And so we can't so quickly judge all of them to be complicit. So where do we go from this? Well, Rabbi Goren says, here's where we should go. From here and from other parts of the tradition that do address the laws of war, and he cites in particular two laws. He cites the law of you can besiege a city, but you have to leave one side open so people can escape. Right? And before you engage even in a melchemet mitzvah, a commanded war, you have to first try to see whether you can reach a peace agreement, even before a commanded war. And he says, there's an ethos here. And there's an ethos here of a kind of sensibility, of restraint, and of mercy towards people who are innocent and swept into the problems of war, but who themselves are not directly killing. And we have to be sensitive to that. And he reconciles the passage between Maimonides and Nachmanides as follows. He says, Maimonides states the law, but Nachmanides states lifnim mishurat hadin. Maimonides states, right, Yaakov hadin et hahar. This is the strict law. It can be justified legally. We can't punish Shimon and Levi. But did they act properly? Did they act in a way that we would consider ethical, even if they didn't violate the law, the halacha? That's a different question. And Rabbi Goren is insisting that there can be, of course, halachot that you haven't violated, but you still could be a scoundrel within the letter of the law, as the phrase goes. Or you could be a person who hasn't exhibited an extra level of ethical sensibility, even though you haven't violated the halakha. And he says that's what the curse is about. When the curse of Yaakov to his sons, the curse of Yaakov to his sons is saying, you may have not violated the halakha, but you nonetheless committed a chilul Hashem. You were overly violent. You need to take that in. You need to learn also an ethos of mercy, of ethics above and beyond the law. And Rabbi Goren draws on this in a very elaborate way. Now, Rabbi Goren is not saying that these ethical ideas should in fact rule the army. He's not delusional. He was a chief rabbi of the military. He was an army man. Right? He knows that in the end of the day, the laws of war of the international community are the accepted standard. But he thinks that Jews, if they want, religious Jews, if they want to understand themselves as having a serious religious Jewish identity in which they don't park the halakha and the whole tradition at the door at tough times, we'll have to look at this to develop a Jewish ethic, not a Jewish law, meaning not a norm that you must abide by, but rather a sense of how you approach things, an ethic, so that if you can't live up to that standard, you feel at least sorry, you feel at least uncomfortable, you don't feel like I'm entitled to do whatever I want. That's one thing, that it creates a situation of building character, a certain kind of character. And the second is that it enables Jews to participate in conversations about how we aspire to be, even if we're not like that in reality today, and to have something to say, to add to the conversation, to not solely go back and say, well, we didn't deal with war, so we have nothing to say, so we just borrow whatever the other communities do. And that's it. So I think this is where there's a very, very interesting debate, and the debate tells us something about the nature of halakha. Is it just a legal system? Is it ethical? What is it? And it tells us something also about the quest for Jewish identity. So I'm going to stop there for a moment because I know you have some questions. We have about 5 minutes left for questions, and I'm happy to hear them now. Said it this way. What's the implication of Yaakov cursing them? That they should have done it or shouldn't have done it? What's the implication of his cursing? So when you say shouldn't have, do you mean it was illegal, or do you mean it wasn't right, or it means that historically we're glad he did it? What do you mean by the should? Of course. Or not, right? We can debate that, right? And we do. I mean, we have, you know, I just listened to 3 lectures on international, on trying to develop international law, in which this was the crux of the debate. Right. So, but I want to take your question and just use it to make a point, which is, as I said, Rabbi Goren is not really addressing the question of what to do in the moment, right? Because you can't address the question what to do in the moment. Those are all these political judgments or experience or an instinct, what to do in the moment. He's addressing the question, what sort of people with what kind of character are going to be making that decision? Right? So when the United States decided to drop the bomb, its background, its tradition, its self-identity shaped its thinking about this in different ways. When Jews in Israel make these decisions, what's shaping their decisions when they come into it as people? What's their character like? How do they act? How do they respond? How do they feel about what they did? That's a character question. And that character issue is what Rabbi Goren is really addressing. He's asking, who are these decision makers? And who are our soldiers? What have been the sources that have nourished them? And how does the public then respond when things happen? Do they respond with horror when innocent people are killed? Do they respond with glee? What differentiates us? Right? Are we like Hamas, that we all dance around with blood on our hands? Or do we, in fact, feel differently about it, feel sorry and sad that we have to engage in it? But we do. Right, that those are very different kinds of responses, and that's what Rabbi Goren is trying to extract from the idea of Shem. It's not about yes or no. It's about what kind of character have we developed, what do we think about, what are our sensibilities like, having looked at this material and taken it in, and not said, oh, you know, this doesn't speak to things like war and politics. Does that help? Okay. Yeah. Question. Right, that's a very good point, that it was their, right, their wish for vengeance overcame them, and their sense of wanting to avenge their sister's honor, and it was impulsive, and it wasn't based on, right, it was a giving in to emotions as opposed to a situation of thinking, I must do this. So if this is what Rabbi Goren at least was hoping one would extract from the sources and why he objected very strongly to the approach of Rabbi Yisraeli. His objection to the approach of Rabbi Yisraeli is it makes everything irrelevant. It just says, look, halachically, by law, you can use Dina Zemalchut Adina. It's an interesting permit. It's a brilliant opinion legally. I mean, it's a lot of legal gymnastics that are really brilliant and very novel to think about the world community as subject to the norm of Dina Zemalchut Adina. But he worried about that. He worried that that was bad for Jewish society. Of course not. Right. Right. Yes. No, we have, I've just participated in a debate, I didn't say anything, I just listened, but I was listening to a debate about just this the other day, and it really split the room between older people and younger people. It was very interesting. Younger people were against it because they're raised in a sensibility in which the notion that it saved American lives is not given priority over the question of how many lives, in which lives are part of kind of a big mass. And that it was fascinating to listen to that and see that, actually. It was really fascinating. Exactly. It is. No, it is. It is a very interesting aspect of contemporary life. People I haven't heard from. Right. That's very good. That's actually what Rabbi Goren says. Right. It's terrific. He says that's exactly, because there is this question, because the text tells you that they acted in, right, that certain of this, some of this deceit was in front of Yaakov. So Yaakov obviously agreed to some of it. And what actually Rabbi Goren and others before him have pointed out is that what he agreed to was the resnatching of Dinah and killing Shechem himself, but not the rest of it.
Right, so that's, yes. I agree with you. The mere point that I was making, I totally agree with you about, I mean, making moral equivalency is, I think it's a terrible thing in the contemporary age, the notion that of not being able to really distinguish between communities. The subject of this, in a way, of Rabbi Goren is, that's the point. You need to be a moral community, right? You can't just assume that you can be like everybody else. It's another generation which believes it's part of a world community. And so, some of this is purely academic, obviously. A lot of this is, you know, academic. But it's interesting from the perspective of sensibility and what kind of sensibility you bring to the table. I don't disagree with you. I'm not disagreeing with you. Right, I'm just pointing out the flip side of understanding that we aren't all morally equivalent. The flip side of our not being all morally equivalent, which is what you're saying, right? There are good guys, there are bad guys. There are some moral communities and there are communities that are not moral. The flip side of it is, how do you become a moral community? That's the flip side, right? What do you do? How do you look at that? It isn't just fiat. Right. So I'm going to give one person, there's one last question. Yes, or two, right? Sorry. Yes. Rav Shaul Yisraeli. Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and that's a very large topic about, they said, right, whether it's okay to deceive. You know, a lot of people have written about this altogether because it's a very interesting theme altogether in Breishit. There's a lot of deception in Breishit. And it doesn't seem to be troubling a lot of people all the time, unless you swear something in the name of God, right? Or you have a treaty, a real treaty. Nobody addresses that, and I think it's interesting because it's part of a larger issue. I mean, Yaakov and Esav, right? Was it wrong to deceive? Yeah, but they didn't have a brit, which is different, right? They didn't conclude a formal agreement. This because you can't separate out the agreement and the deception, right? They said yes deceivingly. The only time you know that it's not, you know, you can rely on it is when you actually formulate it, you know, you put it down in writing. They lived up to their side of the bargain, right? They lived up to their side of the bargain. You're asking a much larger, very interesting question that doesn't just pervade this story, but it pervades all of Breishit, actually. A very interesting question about the role of deception. Okay, I am told that I'm finished.